Beyond the Burr Oaks, Chapter 8. The doctor came and went without a word from me. For hours I lay there, staring at the ceiling, deaf to all questions that were asked. I felt that I wanted to lie there forever. I had forgotten Dora and all the rest. But an illusion of old Dave on his deathbed, thinking I had forsaken him, was before my eyes continually. For 3 sickening days that followed, I lay in the dull cell under the doctor's care. Not once did I wince from the physical pain as I did from the mental. Day by day, my heart would expand with sorrow until it seemed that was all that remained of me. Companionship I detested. Meals were carried in and out, untouched. It was at the end of the 9th day that I asked the sheriff for a drink of water, which he seemed glad to get for me. After I had quenched my thirst, he propped my head up on pillows and asked me how I felt. "Some better," I replied. "Do you know, Ken," he went on, seeing my condition had improved, "I can't for the life of me see why Dora squealed on you." "Dora?" I gasped weakly. "Dora? Never." "Yes, Ken. She's the one who called and told me someone was making moonshine on the old McDonald place." "I don't believe she did it. Not if she knew I was the one over there." "Well, she did, Ken. So there is no guessing about it. I even drove out there to the Lane place and questioned her about how she happened to know that moonshine was being manufactured on the McDonald place." And what did she say?" I sneered, doubting every word he said. "Well, it seems like Roy Tanner had mentioned something about moonshine being made over there. She didn't take Roy's word for it, so sometime Monday night she investigated for herself." "And what did she see?" I interrupted him. "Just as she was about to emerge from the timber that surrounded the bootlegger's cabin, a team and sleigh drove up. The driver made many trips into the cabin, each time returning with a couple of jugs, then with sacks of something. When the sleigh had a fair-sized load, the man drove off down the old stage road." "Did she know I was in the cabin?" I asked. "That's more than I know, Ken," he replied. "Anyway, being convinced that Roy's gossip was true," he continued, "she went home, hitched one of the horses to the cutter, and drove over to a neighbor's from where she phoned me, and you know the consequences." "Then she doesn't know that I was the one you arrested?" I asked eagerly. "Yep, she did, my boy. She begged to go along and sat in the sleigh while we raided the place. Well, after some arguing, I consented. It was kind of comical when we dragged you out unconscious. Why, she just gave a yelp and toppled over the sleigh seat in a sort of faint, and..." "There's someone coming," I cut in as I heard footsteps in the corridor. It was the doctor. He examined me thoroughly. Then, patting my shoulder, said cheerfully, "Well, my boy, today you can get up if you want to. You'll find your muscles a little sore, but otherwise you're okay." That afternoon, when I became accustomed to walking, the sheriff invited me into his office. There, I confronted Carl Faring, who snickered as I stepped into the room. Forgetting my weakened condition, I made an awkward lunge at him, but the agile sheriff, sensing trouble, stepped between us just in time to be the recipient of the blow intended for Carl. The sheriff's head flew back, and a red color flamed in his face, from which his small, beady eyes peered at me angrily, As grasping me roughly by the shoulder, he hurled me into a chair behind the desk with terrific force. "Now, Ken," he began coldly as he took a chair close by, "there's no sense in this rowdy stuff, because it's going to cause you more trouble than good." "Well, what's the idea of his being here?" I asked doggedly with a slouchy motion toward Carl. "That's just what I'm getting to if you give me time," retorted the sheriff hotly. "Carl has come in behalf of Roy Tanner." "And I suspect you believe him," I quizzed. "Why not? His word ought to be as good as yours. Carl hasn't been arrested for making moonshine, and furthermore, I haven't seen him drunk." "Maybe you haven't, but that don't say he's telling the truth," I hissed. "How does he know so darn much about Roy's business? I'd like to..." "Huh," interrupted Carl. "I ought to know, for he's been staying at our home for a week." "You liar!" I yelled, jumping up. "Set down," commanded the sheriff. "All that's a matter with you is, you're afraid Roy's going to beat your time," sneered Carl with a tormenting grin. Being helpless to defend myself, I turned to the sheriff and asked pleadingly, "Sheriff, won't you take me back to my cell?" Without a word, he let me lead the way back to the cell where I slouched into an old, dilapidated chair. Oh, how I prayed to be free just long enough to choke the life out of this contemptible, lying sneak. As I thought of his last remark, I swore that some day he would eat those same words. As the time dragged by, my tormented mind forced me to see but one way to help matters, and that was to escape. Escape meant scheming, and that I did. It was not long before I had conceived an idea. At first, it made me shudder when I thought of what it would mean when I was captured again. I could see Roy Tanner in the little lane cabin, taking my place there and whispering poisoning words in the ears of those I loved. He must have convinced them that I was a coward and that he had come to their rescue. If he had not done so, they would have been up to the jail to see me. The evening shadows had begun to thicken when I heard the sheriff coming down the corridor. Hurriedly sliding into the bunk, I watched him through slit eyes as he entered. "Here's your chow," he remarked, putting it on the chair by the bed. "I don't want anything to eat," I retorted. "What I want is a square deal." "Huh," he grunted. "I guess you're getting that, ain't you?" "No, I'm not," I blurted out, half crying with anger. "I want you to arrest Roy Tanner, or let me go and fetch him here." "Oh, forget Roy Tanner. He'll more than likely turn up at the trial, and that will be soon enough when you hear what he has to say." "Did Carl Faring tell you that Roy would be at the trial?" I asked with interest. "Yeah. Why?" "For God's sake, Dick, don't believe what Carl Faring has told you. Whatever he has said is just a damn big lie, for he is getting even with me for the lickin' I gave him over a month ago, and he'll say anything to make things worse for me." "I'm sorry, Ken, but I won't be able to arrest Roy without some evidence," he said, leaving the cell. When he was out of sight, I quickly ran to the door and tried it to see if it was locked. It was. I scrutinized every bar for a possible chance of escape, but it was of no avail. Sauntering back to the bunk, disappointed, I flung myself across it. There, I debated with myself whether or not I should resort to my felonious scheme of 10 minutes prior. On the chair, still, sat my supper. Taking the heavy cup, which contained coffee, I gulped its contents down in two swallows. Then, with trembling hands, I unlaced my shoe and removed my socks, carefully slipping the cup into the sock. The fit was snug. What a suitable weapon it made! A satisfied smile spread over my face as I grasped the sock above the ankle and tried it on the pillow of my bunk. Pulling the chair, on which my supper sat, up close to the bunk, I crawled into bed where I lay with my arm over my head, gripping the vicious weapon which hung out of sight over the opposite side of the bunk. Hearing the sheriff approaching, I feigned sleep. When his footsteps came to a halt at the edge of the bunk, I slowly opened my eyes. He was bent over the tray of dishes in an act of picking it up. Taking good aim, I delivered a blow with such terrible force that the cup crumbled as it came into contact with the back of the sheriff's head. He sank to the floor without so much as a whisper. I dropped the sock containing the crushed cup and slipped the shoe on my bare foot. Clutching my leggings under my arm, I made my way out without either hat or coat.
Oh.